So for these people, the COVID-19 really makes them believe that their radical fantasies can easily come true. So what exactly President Trump wants, I don't know. Russia is in a difficult situation after COVID-19. The Russian government didn't play the crisis particularly well. President Putin was not seen during the important part of the crisis. It was the mayor of Moscow.
Das war die Stimme von Ivan Krastev. Ist bulgarischer Politologe und Bestsellerautor. Und kommt in dieser Folge noch sehr ausführlich zu Wort. Aber drei nach. Folge 4. Ivan Krastev im Regen und Sebastian Kurz am Schirm.
Die Presse in Albach. Ein Erzählpodcast in 5 Teilen. Präsentiert von Accenture Österreich, dem weltweit führenden Beratungsunternehmen für Digitalisierung.
Albach has always been a great platform, and I'm happy that we also have the opportunity to discuss this year, even if the situation is a bit different than in the last years.
Das war, wie vermutlich unschwer zu erkennen war, Bundeskanzler Sebastian Kurz bei seinem einzigen Auftritt im Rahmen des Forums dieses Jahr. Er hat am Montag der zweiten Woche in einer sogenannten Breakout-Session gesprochen, die zumindest dem Titel nach fast ein bisschen an seine Rede an die österreichische Bevölkerung ein paar Tage davor erinnerte. Resetting the Agenda, Boosting the Central Eastern European Economy Post-Covid-19. So lautete der Titel dieser Veranstaltung, und da diskutierten auf Einladung der Raiffeisenbank International Kristalina Georgieva, die erst seit vergangenem Oktober Direktorin des Internationalen Währungsfonds ist, und Johann Strobel, der CEO von Raiffeisen International, mit dem Kanzler. Kristalina Georgieva versprühte vorsichtige Zuversicht, indem sie unter anderem sagte, die Erholung kommt, sie ist aber partiell und uneinheitlich. Zwischendurch gab es da leider ein paar Internetprobleme, vor allem mit der Leitung aus dem Bundeskanzleramt, aber nach einem Reset der Videoschaltung war das dann auch bald wieder behoben. Kurz betonte in der Session unter anderem, dass es keine Blaupause gebe, wie man eine solche Krise löst. Es brauche aber jedenfalls eine starke Kooperation in Europa, um die Krise wirtschaftlich und politisch bewältigen zu können. Und er betonte interessanterweise in Bezug auf die mit 1. September geschlossenen ungarischen Grenzen, wie wichtig es sei, darauf zu achten, dass in unserer Region die Grenzen offen bleiben.
I think what we need in the region is a strong cooperation. We have to work hard to keep the borders open if possible. And of course, on a European level, I think the main goal is to first support those countries who have been hit hardest by the pandemic. Then second, strengthen our economies and the common market again. And of course, the third point is to make our countries more sustainable and fit for the digital age.
Und weil diese Diskussion von ORF-Moderatorin Lisa Gardenstätter geleitet wurde, fällt mir da noch etwas ein. Der ORF ist dieses Jahr zum zweiten Mal in Albach zu Gast, und zwar mit dem Frühstücksfernsehen Guten Morgen Österreich.
Das Forum Albach, das 75. wird natürlich
eine Woche lang berichtet das Morgenfernsehteam also aus dem Ort. Der Übertragungswagen parkt auf dem Buswendeplatz hinter dem neuen Hotel Alpacherin und schräg gegenüber vom Kongresszentrum. Und der ORF macht somit auch ein bisschen Werbung für Ort und Forum. Thematisch ging es Anfang der Woche beim Forum weiterhin auf fast jedem Panel direkt oder indirekt um die Auswirkungen der Covid-19-Krise, vor allem in politischer und wirtschaftlicher Hinsicht. Den Beisatz "In the light of the pandemic" hört man dieser Tage wirklich häufig.
Preliminary conclusion is nothing will be after this crisis anymore as it was before.
Auf diesen Panels aufgetreten sind da unter anderem die Außenministerin von Liechtenstein, Katrin Eggenberger, Martin Sellmeier, seit Herbst Leiter der Vertretung der Europäischen Kommission in Österreich, Gabriel Felbermeier vom Institut für Weltwirtschaft in Kiel und die österreichische Justizministerin Alma Sadic. Auch über Economic and Climate Recovery wurde diskutiert, am Beispiel des Green Deal der EU. Dazu war Valdis Dombrovski, der Vizepräsident der EU-Kommission, zugeschaltet, und Österreichs Ministerin Eleonore Gewessler war vor Ort im Herz-Kremenag-Saal. Aber jetzt genug mit dem Name und Topic Dropping, denn eigentlich wollen wir diese Folge ja etwas anders angehen als die bisherigen. Nämlich in die Tiefe gehen und uns für einen Gesprächspartner mal richtig Zeit nehmen.
Ladies and gentlemen, the program is about to continue. Please take your seats.
Dieses hohe Pfeifen, das ist übrigens ein Murmeltierschrei aus der Signation des Europäischen Forums und er gehört normalerweise zum Kongressalltag. Denn wenn sich im Kongresszentrum eine Session an die andere reiht, erinnert dieser Ton kurz vor dem Beginn einer neuen Veranstaltung die Besucher daran, dass es Zeit ist, den Smalltalk einzustellen und wieder Platz zu nehmen. In diesem Jahr kommt der typische Murmeltierweckruf allerdings weniger häufig zum Einsatz als sonst, weil man zugegebenermaßen die Internetstreamer eher nicht durch einen solchen Ordnungsruf an die Bildschirme holen muss. Dafür soll der Schrei jetzt hier gewissermaßen unsere nächste Session einleiten. Ich habe nämlich den bulgarischen Politologen Ivan Krastev getroffen und zwar zu einem sehr ausführlichen Gespräch über wichtige weltpolitische Dinge, die uns gerade bewegen. Krastev befindet sich sogar ein paar Tage in Alpbach, weil er, wie er sagt, die Atmosphäre hier sehr schätzt und den Ort wirklich gerne hat. Der 1965 in Sofia geborene Publizist ist unter anderem Permanent Fellow am Institut für die Wissenschaften von Menschen in Wien und hat somit eine enge Verbindung zu Wien und Österreich. Er versteht auch ganz gut Deutsch, unser Gespräch haben wir trotzdem auf Englisch geführt. Krastev tritt auch hier und da beratend für bulgarische Regierungsmitglieder auf und er hat vor allem zahlreiche sehr empfehlenswerte Bücher geschrieben. Nach Das Licht, das erlosch aus dem Vorjahr erschien gerade eben Ist heute schon morgen sein kurzer Covid-19-Essay, den er während des Shutdowns auf einem Weingut an der bulgarisch-griechischen Grenze geschrieben hat, wie er mir berichtet hat. Darin formuliert er 7 Paradoxien, die seiner Meinung nach durch die Corona-Krise ausgelöst wurden. So habe das Virus uns zwar die Schattenseiten der Globalisierung aufgezeigt, die Welt aber gleichzeitig auf eine noch nie dagewesene Weise synchronisiert. Schließlich haben ja alle zeitgleich dasselbe erlebt. Über ein anderes Paradoxon sprachen wir gleich zu Beginn. Da waren wir noch voll der Eindrücke der großen Corona-Leugner-Demo in Berlin am letzten Augustwochenende. Krastev ist nämlich der Meinung, dass eher Bürger in Ländern wie Deutschland, die die Covid-19-Krise eigentlich ganz gut überstanden haben, ihre Regierungen lautstark kritisieren werden. Deutschland und Berlin sind da eben ein gutes Beispiel. Wieso er das glaubt, erklärt er gleich zu Beginn.
This was, by the way, a quite simple psychological explanation. You remember, in March, everybody was scared. And when something really tragic did not happen, the idea was that it could not happen. And then they start to look at what government is doing as kind of a overreacting. And this is important because in the beginning of the crisis, there was a feeling, and I was basically sharing the sentiment, that probably COVID-19 is going to restore certain trust, particularly in expertise. And as a result of this, people are going much more to trust their governments. But the results of the opinion polls that I saw recently tells you that, in fact, when it comes to what governments tell you about COVID-19 and what the doctors told you about COVID-19, there are 3 groups of people. There are those who does not trust anybody. And the reasons they don't trust science is because different doctors get different opinions. So this is the way that science works. But this is not people believes that if there is not a common position which is shared by all the doctors, nothing is to be trusted. The second group, and I do believe this group is very important for the protest, was those who believes that the government is using the legitimacy of the doctors in order to justify positions that they have before. And of course, the third is those who are ready to trust the experts on issues like COVID-19. I'm saying this because you have this interesting coalition, both on the far left and on the far right, based on a total mistrust of anything that government is doing. And from this point of view, the more successful the government is, it means that less people are stressed, less they have this experience of a tragedy that you have been places like Italy or Spain where a lot of people died. So for the people that have been on the street, the government is simply misusing the COVID-19 in order basically to restrict their rights.
How big is the part in you that is somehow also thrilled about the fact that you experience such a world-changing thing like a pandemic?
It's interesting because I do believe we have already forgotten what we have been thinking in March and in and April, when it was very new and when everything was very scary. But I do believe that the interesting thing about the pandemic is that it is pushing different people into totally different kind of directions. On one day, people who basically believe that at the end of the day, for the last 20 years, at least three times, we were told that the world is never going to be the same. 9/11, the world is not going to be the same. And then basically global financial crisis, and we're told that the world is never going to be the same.
And the refugee crisis, 2015.
Going to be the same. But at the end of the day, these people said, but the world is the same. So these people are becoming much more nostalgic for this normality, and you're starting basically to underplay what you're seeing, how big is the change. Okay, this is discomfort, but we're overreacting, it's going to be back, it's very much media. This is other type of people who basically take this kind of radical shift as a proof that many things that they believed totally impossible yesterday are becoming possible now. Because I put yourself in the shoes of a kind of a activist, both on the left or on the right. Imagine that you're an environmental activist and you wanted to land all the planes because they're bad for nature. And people are telling you that this is impossible. And then they will land it overnight. Or if you're kind of a radical nationalist and you want to restore and resurrect the borders in the European Union and everybody is telling you that this is impossible, and then when the virus came overnight, all the borders have been closed. So for these people, the COVID-19 really makes them believe that their radical fantasies can easily come true. And I do believe these tensions between the nostalgia to the world of yesterday, born out of COVID-19, when we could travel, where in Aalborg basically you're going to see thousands of people and not this kind of empty streets on one side, and on the other, the much more radical part of the public who said, now we can do it. Things that before we believed that are not doable.
I mentioned your recent book before. The name is It Tomorrow Yet? In German, it's called Ist heute schon morgen? And I found one sentence very, very interesting and also inspiring. You said, for a while we lived in a common world. Do you think that there is a chance in COVID-19 that Europe can reunite in a way, and the European Union?
There is a very plausible scenario that COVID-19 is going to consolidate European Union. And the reason is...
Although you say it's the heaviest and most infecting crisis the European Union ever faced.
Because of it. The problem is that European Union cannot simply survive without moving in one direction or the other. All previous crises were difficult crises, but you can keep the status quo basically dancing on it. It cannot go with this crisis for several reasons. European Union is very vulnerable to the change that we see. We have been much more embedded in this global world than anybody else because we have been the one pushing for this post-sovereignty projects. We are not a normal state. On the other side, European states are too small to play on their own. So when it all happened, well, I was very much involved with this European Council on Foreign Relations big study on the public opinion after COVID-19, and it was the paradox which I really enjoyed. You ask people, do you believe that European Union did well during the public health part of the crisis? And people said no. The majority of the people were quite disappointed. What is the lessons that basically are getting out of this crisis? We need much more European cooperation. Where it comes from? During this crisis, for the first time, people who are never interested in politics, people who are not in this kind of a big talks about what is happening in the world, just staying in front of their TV sets after the lockdown, they discovered that we're in a totally different world. First, America is not the America that we knew. It didn't come. American leadership can be praised or contested by many, but it was always there. This time, America was simply absent, and it's not simply that it was emptied, it was destroyed by this crisis in the eyes of the Europeans to the extent that 62% of the Germans said that their view on the US deteriorated as a result of the crisis. And it's not about Trump only. This is about this totally powerful state extremely rich society, you start to feel sorry about. And China, there was all this kind of a fantasy that China is only interested in economic stuff, that they don't have any ideas to hegemony and dominate the world. And during this crisis, it became clear that China is in a power game. So this realization of the fact that Europe can be squeezed between the Americans and the Chinese, and that if we want to be of any factor in the world, we should go together, is the fact that nevertheless the Europeans were not impressed by what the EU did. We said we should empower the Union in a certain way. We need somebody. And from this point of view, there is a chance. The fact that there is a chance does not mean that necessarily it's going to happen.
Mm. So. The question is how the European Union can manage to do that. I mean, you can say it, it's very easily to say, yeah, that there's a chance to take something out of it, but what should the EU do? And I mean, as you said before, there are a lot of people who have the feeling that they did not manage very well with the whole crisis.
No, this is the majority of the people, not many people. This is the majority of the people. Listen, the most important thing that changed is how Germany is viewing the world. Because Germany is very different compared to the other EU member states for several reasons. First is the size. It's a relatively big country. For European standards, it's a very big country. But secondly, what is even more important economically, well, for example, Austria is mostly trading within the European Union. Germany is mostly trading outside of the European Union. 42% of all European exports to China are coming from Germany. So the relations between Germany, I mean economic relations, and the United States are incredibly developed. So suddenly, it was as a result of this crisis that Germany betted on the EU in the way it was not betted before. Because 10 years ago, during the global financial crisis, the very talk about mutualization of debt was a no-go. And then suddenly, Germany understood, particularly after Brexit, particularly after the new dynamics in the American-Chinese relations, that you need the European Union that matters, which means basically you need European Union that is going to have some financial power of its own, but secondly, could stand. Because before, we always believed that we're going to regulate others, assuming that we're living in a common world. Now when the prospect of American world and Chinese world became much more realistic, technology starting to play the role of ideology before. Tell me what kind of a 5G network you have and I'm going to tell you where your political loyalty goes, whom exactly we're going to regulate. And I do believe this change of a German's position is something new, and this is why the recovery plan was very different of what happened after the global financial crisis, where Germany was playing the role that basically the Frugal Five were playing during this discussion.
I would like to stay with Germany and a total different topic, Navalny. What is your take on that? That Berlin said, yes, we want Navalny to come to our country and to the city and to get checked at the Charité. And what is your general take on the whole Navalny story?
The biggest problem, we don't know, at least. I don't know exactly what has happened. The European public opinion has a very good reasons not to trust Russian government when it comes to poisoning and how you're treating basically your critics after the Skripal case and basically seeing how huge was the pressure on Navalny. And I do believe for Germany, this type of a gesture of humanitarian support have been always very important. Don't forget that it was in Germany that also Khodorkovsky landed. So fighting for concrete people, and particularly in this situation, I do believe is very important also for the self-confidence of Germans, which at one side are highly morally minded when they talk about international politics, but also being quite pragmatic and realist at the same time. And this type of a cases are giving to the Germans the feeling that they're on the right side, which I do believe is quite important for any nation, for any government. What is going to be the impact of this on the German-Russian relations is difficult to be said, because for the Russian government, all this crisis with Navalny comes in a moment in which Russia is in a difficult situation after COVID-19. The Russian government didn't play the crisis particularly well. President Putin was not seen during the important part of the crisis. It was the mayor of Moscow, Mr. Sobyanin, who took the leading role, but also in the context of Belarus. where you end up with millions of people protesting and saying, listen, we want a change. We don't want somebody to stay for 26 years governing us. And this is one of the biggest problems the Russian political system is facing today. The strength of the system and the weakness of the system is the same. And this is President Putin. Obviously, he's a very powerful leader. He achieved certain things. But because of it, people cannot imagine how post-Putin Russia is going to look like. Neither his supporters nor much of his critics. So the more he's aging, the more the anxiety is becoming. And he's not helping the society because he's not giving them perspective on a post-Putin Russia. His message to the world and to the Russians is, situation is so tough, so I cannot retire. But this was also, unfortunately, the message of Mr. Lukashenko. And this ended up with people who yesterday genuinely voted for him, now understanding that the only way for Belarus is for him to get out. Yeah.
Is there a reason why Putin was not seen during the crisis?
There was a lot of speculations. He didn't wrote to any of us to explain why he was not there. I do believe that on one level, basically, probably some of his medical advisors and others decided to keep him safe, so there was not much communication. But secondly, this is type of a crisis that this type of political leaders don't like. Because there is nothing heroic about it. Listen, you don't have a control, and also it so much depends on the trust that people has in a government. Because you can arrest million people, but you cannot force people to wash their hands. For this, you need something different. And because the Russian system is not great at delegating powers, so at some point, I do believe that the president himself probably didn't have much clue what is going on. Don't forget, in the beginning, Russia was slightly in a denial camp, trying to help Italy, saying we're doing fine, something that Mr. Lukashenko did. And really, it was very much because of the mayor of Moscow that they decided to lock down. And you know that some of the figures for Russia were difficult. Secondly, also this crisis of globalization is not benefiting Russia. Because while Russia is politically closed countries, it very much depends on the free market for its natural resources. And as a result of it, for the last several years, the incomes of the Russian population has really declined, around 20% decline of the disposable money that people have. And you can go with this for 3 years, for 5 years, when you believe that it's temporal. But when basically for a long period of time you see your money declining, the explanation about the Western sanctions, about COVID-19 are not helping in the way they have been helping before.
Let's come at the end of the interview to another very important event for world politics, which is, of course, the U.S. elections on the 3rd of November. And I just read in a recent piece for the FT that you wrote, where you shared a new theory about Trump's foreign policy, and where you said that after post-Brexit EU, the U.S. is seeking for new allies, and one of them is Central Europe, with also Austrian. Could you elaborate a bit more on that, why that is?
Now listen, normally, when people talk about U.S. policy towards the European Union, on one level, they point the obvious, that unlike different previous American presidents, President Trump does not see European Union and European unity as an objective of the American foreign policy. But secondly, they basically claim and he wants to destroy the EU. So what exactly President Trump wants, I don't know. But on the other side, you can see that the foreign policy of the United States, much more personified by the State Department and in this case by the visit of State Secretary Pompeo, he has a slightly different view of what is important about Europe. As you know, for 2 years, Assistant Secretary of State on Europe was Wes Mitchell. Wes Mitchell is an extremely gifted Republican geopolitical strategist who knows very well, by the way, this part of the world, because he wrote a fascinating book on the grand strategy of the Habsburg Empire. So he's a specialist on the Habsburgs. And one of the central points in understanding of Europe and European Union from the point of view of Mitchell was that if Europe gets sovereign, if Europe goes united, this is going to be problematic for the transatlantic relationship because there is a huge risk that European Union is much more going to side with Russia than with the US. So at the same time, the State Department and
this type of American strategy recognizes that disintegration of the European Union is going to be a major problem for the West. So I don't know where President Trump stands, but they understand that this is also going to be perceived as the American defeat. So the idea was to have European Union where there is a block of countries that can constrain Germany. And these countries should be countries which basically have shared fears on one level from Russia, on the other level from Germany. And this is not only about Central and Eastern Europe, because the biggest question was, what is also economically the place? What is the capital that can replace Berlin as the natural point of departure for Central Europeans? And then came the idea that Vienna could be. Vienna could be because of historical tradition. Vienna could be because economically, of course, Austrian businesses are very much present in Central and Eastern Europe. And thirdly, because unlike Mr. Trump, people in the State Department basically are less enthusiastic about Hungary and Hungarian regimes, also on foreign policy terms. And on the other side, they need somebody who is much more moderate and kind of much more reasonable than the Polish government that can go to a big extreme in their relations both with Russia and with Germany. So this is why you ended up with this very interesting last trip of Pompeo to Europe before the elections, in which he visited Vienna, he visited Prague, he visited Slovenia, he visited Poland. He didn't go to Budapest, but he didn't go to Germany or he didn't go to Paris. Normally, you expect. Mm-hmm. And this was the traditional American policy, that the major point of contact for the Americans in Europe was Germany. My major argument is that this is a strategy. This is not simply an instinct. And probably this is not where Trump stands, but this is where Trump's administration stands. And because containing Germany is something that is close to the heart of President Trump, they can also sell this to him. But this strategy is not going to survive if Biden is going to be elected. I do believe if Biden is going to be elected, normally Washington will go first to Berlin, then to any other capital. But the paradox of the Biden elections is going to be that if he is elected, then for countries like Hungary and Poland, who sided very strongly with President Trump, with Biden in the White House, their natural move is going to go closer to Brussels. Mm-hmm. Because the special relationship with the United States is not going to survive. The Democratic Party has kind of a bad feeling of what basically both, particularly Budapest, did. So as a result of it, strangely, the end of this Habsburg strategy of Washington can end up basically with the Hungarians and Poles decided to moderate some of their criticism towards the European Union because they need a shield. They need a partner. Yeah, yeah.
Do you know already how you will follow the elections? Do you plan to go to the States during this phase? Or what are your plans for the next couple of weeks?
You're asking the most difficult questions, because the problem is that with COVID-19, we're not planning.
Yeah.
Normally, I'll go to the US.
Yeah,
and for me, this was quite interesting. I still have not lost the hope that if the situation goes slightly more normalized medically, because when you go to a country the week before and week after the elections, you're learning about the country more than if you're going to stay 2 years before it. So I don't want to miss the opportunity, but I don't know how easy it is going to be. And also, you can go to the United States, whom you're going to meet when people are staying online all the time. So from this point of view, the idea of visiting a country is not what it used to be.
Thank you that you visited Alpbach. Thank you very much.
Alpbach is one of the safest bets that you can do.
Yeah. Especially because there are no people right now. Ivan Krastev weiß also noch nicht, ob er es dieses Jahr zur US-Wahl nach Amerika schaffen wird, obwohl er findet, dass man nie so viel über ein Land lernt wie in den 2 Wochen vor und nach einer Wahl. So oder so wird danach ein neues Buch entstehen. Da bin ich ziemlich sicher. In Alpbach ist jetzt übrigens kurz vor dem Ende abends doch wieder einiges los. Nur das Terrassensitzen vor Jakoba und Böglerhof, das will in diesem Jahr nicht so recht gelingen. Weil auch wenn der Regen zwischendurch gnädigerweise beschließt, für ein paar Stunden aufzuhören, ist es abends bei um die 9 Grad einfach ziemlich frisch zum Draußensitzen. Aber in fast allen Gasthäusern und Almen finden nun täglich Abendessenrunden statt. Da laden Banken, Agenturen oder das Forum selbst zu kleinen Zusammenkünften. Auch die Presse bat gemeinsam mit dem KSV, dem Kreditschutzverband, zu einem Abendessen in den Böglerhof. Andreas Treichl lud schon tags davor ein paar Leute zum Austausch. Aber so richtig groß an die Glocke hängen will das dieses Mal niemand, solche Einladungen. Trotzdem wird hier im Ort, unter denen die da sind, ganz gerne ausgetauscht, wer heute Abend wo mit wem sein Hirschragout isst. Das gehört offenbar zu Alpbach dazu, auch in einem Jahr wie diesem. Das war Episode 4 unserer Hörreportage aus Alpbach. Die fünfte und abschließende Folge kommt am Donnerstag, den 3. September um 18 Uhr. Auch diese wird wie alle bisherigen Podcasts abrufbar sein unter diepresse.com/podcast und überall, wo es Podcasts gibt. Wer noch Zeit und Lust hat, kann uns natürlich auch gerne eine Bewertung auf Apple oder Google Podcasts hinterlassen. Das würde uns sehr freuen. Genauso freuen wir uns auch über Feedback, zum Beispiel per Post an die Mailadresse podcast@diepresse.com. Wer noch mehr Stoff aus Forum Alpbach sucht, Texte, Interviews und Analysen dazu finden sich täglich in der gedruckten Zeitung und noch bis Donnerstag in einem eigenen E-Paper, das Erich Kotziner, Tina Stani und Michael Köttritsch zusammenstellen unter diepresse.com/alpbach.